A literary legend has died. Not an author, but the publisher behind some of the most famous and controversial writers of the 20th century. Barney Rossett gave American readers their first taste of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. He also published uncensored versions of classics by Henry Miller and D.H. Lawrence that had been considered scandalous. To do that, Rossett fought literally hundreds of court cases that helped to break down U.S. obscenity laws in the 1950s and 60s. Barney Rossett died last night in New York City, just a few months shy of his 90th birthday. John Kalish has this appreciation.
Barney Rossett was the son of a wealthy Chicago banker. During World War II, he served as a photographer and afterwards tried his hand at filmmaking. Then, in 1951, he bought a nearly defunct publishing company named Grove Press.
Grove Press was three titles and maybe 100 copies of each, right? Enough to fit in a suitcase. No financial records, no nothing.
Rossett published Waiting for Godot in 1954 because no other American publisher was interested in Samuel Beckett, as he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1991.
When I started publishing, I most definitely would have liked to have published Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald, but they were already published.
In 1957, Rossett launched the Evergreen Review, which became one of the most important magazines of the 1960s counterculture. 2 years later, he found himself waging a legal battle over D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover because of its frank sexuality. Rossett went all the way to the Supreme Court, where he won a First Amendment victory. But that was just part of a calculated strategy to publish another banned book, Henry Miller's 1934 autobiographical novel, Tropic of Cancer.
To do Lady Chatterley's Lover before Tropic of Cancer would be more acceptable because D.H. Lawrence was a famous writer and revered at many levels, and Lady Chatterley would be more feasible to make a battle plan for, and we did exactly that.
Rossett landed in court hundreds of times, battling obscenity charges over books and the popular Swedish film I Am Curious Yellow. Again, Rossett prevailed. And though the success of that film helped pay many of his legal bills, Rossett was never about making money, says Claudia Menza, a former managing editor at Grove.
Barney didn't publish erotica because he thought it would help us monetarily. He published it because he liked it. That's the way he published everything. He did it because he liked it.
Over the years, Grove Press published John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces and Eric Byrne's popular look at transactional analysis, Games People Play. Rossett published the autobiography of Malcolm X after Doubleday dropped it and a who's who of 20th century playwrights. Grove Press's place in American literary history is considerable, says Stan Guntarski, a professor at Florida State University.
It nourished other writers. It nourished the intellectual climate of the United States. It produced a whole host of editors that went on to work for other presses, to found their own presses. It had a profound impact in a broad cultural venue.
But Barney Rossett was never a very good businessman, and Grove was often in financial trouble. He was forced to sell in 1985. And though he continued publishing online, Rossett told NPR 3 years ago that the loss of Grove Press and his shortcomings as a businessman still haunted him.
I think we published a lot of good books. A lot. But I ultimately goofed terribly.
For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
The publishing business is not really known as a hotbed of technological innovation, but this past week in New York, the Tools of Change Digital Publishing Conference attracted entrepreneurs and innovators who aren't afraid of the future. They are inspired by it. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, this was not your usual publishing industry crowd.
It was the kind of crowd where some were more inclined to say, steal my book, than to argue over what an e-book should cost. These are people who see digital publishing not as a threat, but as an opportunity. Joe Weichert of O'Reilly Media, which hosted the conference, says digital publishing is in its infancy, but the potential is endless.
If you come up with something new and exciting, you can change the rules and the playing field overnight. Smashwords is an ebook publishing and distribution platform. We make it really easy for any writer anywhere in the world to instantly publish an ebook.
Mark Coker is founder of Smashwords, a self-publishing company which he introduced for the first time at this same conference 4 years ago. In its first year, Smashwords published 400 books. Now it has published more than 100,000. The company's biggest competitor is the behemoth Amazon, but that doesn't scare Coker. He distributes Smashwords books to any other ebook retailer that wants them. A writer himself, Coker believes the power base in publishing is shifting.
The power to create great books and the power to distribute great books is transferring to the author. Just a few years ago, publishers controlled the printing press, and they controlled the access to retail distribution. So if you couldn't get your book printed and you couldn't get it distributed, you'd never reach readers. But today, the printing press has become completely democratized. It's on the internet. It's in the cloud. Anyone can use it. And the distribution is democratized.
Smashwords doesn't edit or curate its books. Coker says the readers should decide which books will rise to the top and which will fail. And in the brave new world of digital publishing, says Coker, a book is a constant work of progress.
In the old days, in the print book days, books were relatively static objects. The publisher would wrap up the book, ship it out, and that book rarely changed. But with ebooks, there are these dynamic creatures. Authors have the ability to change anything about the book at any time.
And why wait until a book is finished to find out what readers are thinking? Dominique Rocca, CEO and publisher of Sourcebooks, is experimenting with the agile publishing model, which allows authors and readers to interact as the book is still being written.
You're really publishing into a community already. So what you're going to be doing is developing the book in front of that community, having the community interact with the author to develop the book, provide feedback on how, you know, what's good, what's not so good, or directions, and ask questions. And then you're publishing then at the end of that developmental process.
A lot of the digital publishing experiments that are getting underway today may not be here a few years from now. But Raga says the experimentation is key to learning what will and won't work in the future. Peter Myers, author of Breaking the Page, Transforming Books and the Reading Experience, says when the dust settles, the book as we know it may be different. Digital enhancements may even make the book smarter. But the experience of reading will be fundamentally the same.
Once we get through the next couple years of mania, and that's really where I think we're at. I think we're in an intense period of speculation that's very similar to the dot-com boom of the mid and late 90s. Once we get through here, people will take a deep breath and will say, okay, the book is not dying. Is the print book diminishing in its presence? Of course. But the function of the book itself as a break and a refuge and a chance to spend immersive time with an author telling a story, I think is incredibly valuable.
Whatever the future may hold, Dominique Rocca says, the present is a great time to be in the business of publishing.
And I really feel tremendously blessed that we all get to have this conversation about what the book can be in the future. What does it mean? How does it work? How do we expand the boundaries of the book? This is a conversation worth living for.
Rocca says when she first got involved in digital publishing, she thought she would be developing products for her children's generation. She was wrong about that. The future, as it turns out, is now. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
In war-torn Congo, the heart of Africa, a convoy of private military contractors carrying a U.S. senator to a secret mine is about to run into trouble.
In the middle car, the package is still staring out of the window, a look of horror forming on his face. It's as though the anticipation has spread, as though it's a virus or a stain, alive somehow, crimson and thirsty. Ray swallows. He's thirsty himself, the feeling in his veins now inexorable, like a dark, slowly uncoiling sexual desire that senses imminent release. He puts his finger on the trigger.
That shooting is the first strand in a complicated web that makes up our book this week, the new thriller Bloodland. Author Alan Glynn, that's his voice you just heard, unfolds a story of corruption and murder and cover-ups. And Alan Glynn joins us now from Dublin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So tell me, in just a few seconds, what's the book about?
The book is a political thriller which takes us from Dublin via New York to the Congo. It deals with illegal mining of metals in the Congo and the relationship that they have to corporate boardrooms in New York. It's an exploration of the, if you like, the power dynamics that go on between these two things.
A lot of manipulation of power and shady backroom deals and all this. Well, I was so struck by, you do have all these kind of grand themes, as you just mentioned. But instead of, you know, lecturing about them from lofty heights, you really take it down to these just, you have this great cast of quite seedy characters, people who are outwardly powerful but inwardly have their issues. Was that a deliberate way to tell the story?
Yeah, I think the danger with something like this is to be polemical. If you start with an agenda, a political agenda, in fiction, you're asking for trouble. It's important to kind of not preach, even though at the heart of the story there is a kind of a political point, I think. But what really interests me is the psychology of these people in these positions of power. And characters which, you know, on the surface, on the page, might seem extremely unsympathetic. I think by getting close to the way they think, there's a certain ambivalence that comes out, which is interesting.
Which character did you have the most fun writing?
I like James Vaughan, the character. He's a kind of a grey eminence, if you like, behind the book.
And he's the international financier, right? Kind
yes.
of a George Soros gone bad.
Yeah, he runs a private equity company called the Oberon Capital Group. He's a guy in his early 80s. He's been around for a long time. And I'm just fascinated by someone who's been so involved on so many levels of the power structures in the way the world has developed to today.
Without giving away any of the twists and turns in your book, it is safe to say that a lot of the characters here make very bad choices. They, you know, they land in trouble and it's
yes.
entirely of their own making.
Yes, and I think, and then they make further choices, which get them further into kind of knottier trouble spots, which is fun, I think, to fun to write, and it's fun to watch how they dig deeper into the hole that they're in.
Let me ask you to focus in on one of them, and this is the character Larry Bulger. He, until quite recently in your book, was Prime Minister of Ireland. He's now out of a job, and he's also an alcoholic who had not had a sip in a decade until now. And you have a great scene in there where you describe him in his living room. He's standing in front of his liquor cabinet. He's reached out and he's touching a bottle of whiskey. I wonder if you would read that passage for us. Page 63.
Sure. He raises the glass to his lips and slurps. Slurps whiskey. The taste of it. The feel of it going down. Oh, my God. He holds the glass in front of him, stares at it in disbelief, raises it to his lips again, takes a couple of genteel sips just for confirmation. Already he can feel it. That burning sensation in his stomach. Already he can feel those familiar cravings, sudden and impatient. For a cigarette, for company, for another sip. He turns around and takes one.
One interesting thing, hearing you read that, it's all in the present tense. It's a little
yes.
jarring because most fiction, you realize, is written in the past tense. Why did you choose to do it that way?
You say most fiction is in the past. I suppose it is, but there's a pretty good tradition of writing in the present tense. Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow is written in the present tense. It's just, it's more immediate, and we're swept along, I think, with the events of the story in a more immediate way.
I'm speaking with Alan Glynn about his new thriller, Bloodland. And Alan Glynn, let me ask you about the character, your kind of protagonist, who's the one trying to unravel all of these various twists and turns, is a journalist named Jimmy. And you write, I mean, as a journalist reading this, I thought, wow, he kind of got it right. He gets how it works. Were you ever a journalist yourself?
Oh, well, thank you. That's good to hear because, no, I haven't been a journalist. I don't think I have what it takes to meet deadlines. I know journalists. I've spoken to some. And it also deals with the whole crisis that's going on at the moment in newspapers, with newspapers closing and all of that stuff. He's kind of bang in the middle of that. He's very young. He's not that experienced. And he's looking for a place in a news organization where he can, you know, do what he wants to do, which is follow a story.
Now, as this young reporter is trying to follow the story, the reader is following along with him, and that's how a lot of the plot twists in the book unfold. I am always fascinated when I speak to writers to find out, did you know what was going to happen? I mean, when you start writing a book like this, do you know how it's all going to end?
No, I don't. I don't really plan in great detail at all. It's I'm always reminded of that great quote by E.L. Doctorow. He said writing a novel is like, you know, driving a car at night. You know, you can just see as far as the headlights will show you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I think that keeps it fresh for the writer as well as the reader.
So you're getting to know the characters yourself as you write them on the page. Yeah,
it's kind of a tightrope walk in a way too, because you know, it's a confidence trick that you play on yourself as well as the reader. If you look down, you know you can fall.
We've mentioned this. The action in this book is set largely in Dublin, where you live, and also action unfolds in New York, in Italy. But several of the key scenes are in Africa, in Congo, a place I'm assuming you have not personally lived in. How do you deal with that challenge of describing a place that you haven't yourself gotten to know very well?
I did a lot of research. And also the scenes in the Congo are filtered through characters who are not from there. And I think that helped me a bit, too.
You're not trying to write in the voice of an African. But on the other hand, it's fiction. I mean, you could make up whatever you want. How important is it to you to get it absolutely right?
Absolute 100% accuracy is not so important. I mean, I think James Joyce kind of, you know, flogged that horse to death, really. You know, when he wrote Ulysses, everything had to be inch perfect. Everything he described, he used to write home to his relatives to measure things in the street, you know. So I think once he did that, you know, it was left open after that for anybody to make it up as you go along. But you want to get it right to a certain extent.
Well, again, without wanting to give away any of the twists and turns that unfold on these pages, I think I can safely say that at the end of this one, it seems as though you're setting us up for an epic battle between two of the characters. Your reporter hero, Jimmy, and the wicked Jimmy Vaughn. Are we going to see these characters again?
Yes. The third novel it's kind of a loose trilogy, I've described it. The books can be read separately, but I think they will go together quite well. The third one is called Graveland. I deal with the character of James Vaughn in quite a lot of detail in this new book through his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, back as far as the 1870s and the railroad 70s and the railroads. It sounds pretty ambitious, but we'll see how it goes.
You've got your work cut out for you.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll look forward to that. That's Alan Glynn talking about his latest novel, Bloodland, and we just spoke with him from the studios of RTE in Dublin.
Peggy Lean Bartels had settled into her life. She'd been in America for more than 30 years. She had built a life here, with a great job at Ghana's embassy in Washington, friends, a sense of purpose. But she had no idea destiny would intervene and make her one of the most unlikely leaders in West Africa.
If somebody had told me that one day I'll be a king, I'll tell the person that you are crazy.
But that's exactly what happened to Bartels, and life hasn't been the same since. We went to visit King Peggy, as she's known, at her home just outside Washington, D.C., in Silver Spring, Maryland.
It's Rachel Martin with NPR.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you, too.
It's a modest one-bedroom condo with floral carpet, ornate furniture, and West African art. Pictures of her coronation hang on the wall. In them, Peggy is dressed in the colorful robes of a king, and of course, a crown. And along with the special clothes comes a special name.
What do I call you? Peggy?
Nana?
Nana. Nana's okay?
Yes,
okay.
Nana is okay.
Nana is the title given to elders in her native Ghana. The first time someone called her that was 4 years ago. She was woken up at 4 a.m. with a phone call, one of her cousins back home.
He said, Nana. I said, Nana, what are you talking about? You know, I'm not a king, I'm not a queen. So I thought he was trying to call me or something. So I said, listen, it's 4 o'clock in the morning in the United States. What do you want? So he said, your uncle went to the village.
He's gone to village.
Yes, and he's not coming back anytime soon.
Going to village is what people in Peggy's hometown say when someone has died. The cousin went on. He told Peggy that village elders had carried out a sacred ritual to choose a successor for her uncle, the king. And they had chosen Peggy.
I said, a king? A woman king? Are you kidding me? He said, no, I'm not kidding you. And in Ghana, it's very rare, because at the moment, we only have 3 women king, and I'm the third one.
In the whole country?
In the whole country. And then I said, why in the world would they take a woman far away, so many thousands of miles away, that I'm not going to be there full time right now? Why me?
What convinced you in the end?
I kept on hearing voices, and the voices just say, Nana. That voice called me, Nana. It's your destiny. Go for it. At first I said, is it because I'm tired? I haven't been sleeping? What is this, you know?
Peggy agreed to become king. How could she not? But it hasn't been easy. She remembers her first trip back to Ghana when she met with a group of male elders. One of the men stood up and said,
shut up. You are a woman, and you have to do what we have to tell you.
This was the first big meeting that
yes,
you had
yes,
with
yeah, the, first
the
big
tribal
meeting.
Elders.
That's when I stood up, and I sat down and I said, oh, so you people wake me up 4 o'clock in the morning thinking that I'm a woman, that you're going to really intimidate, and I'm far away, and then you are going to rule me, and then have me there as a public figure. I said, not me. I want to tell you all that I'm serious. Don't look at me as a woman. I'm a man. So if you really understand me as a man, and then we can go on well. But if you think I'm a woman, we're not going to work.
You ended up, and you are currently, fighting a lot of corruption.
Yes.
When did that first become apparent to you, that this was a problem in your village?
The first time that they were installing me.
Like a coronation.
Yes, a coronation. Yes, Americans, you know, and the Europeans call it coronation, but we call it installment. Mm-hmm. The time came for me to be installed, and then I said, who is going to buy the drinks, you know, be responsible for the other stuff? Then I asked the treasurer, and she said, you don't have money, and shrugged his shoulders. Then I said, hey, wait a minute. We have a beach, we have a land there that we have fishermen that they always give us money, like a land fees and fishermen fees.
Like taxes.
Yes, mm-hmm. You know. And I said, what happened to it? He said, we don't know. They kept on shrugging their shoulders. And then this one would be fingering at this one, point fingers at this one. I said, wow, I'm in trouble, but I'll fix it.
So far, she has helped bring clean water to the village, renovated the king's palace, opened the village's first bank, and she's recruited a church in Washington, D.C. to help sponsor more projects, like a secondary school. It's work that has given Peggy a new kind of satisfaction, a new kind of purpose.
How has it changed how you walk through life when you're in America, when you're in Washington, D.C.? I mean, you're a king.
I know. But you know what? Sometimes, you know, I don't let it get to me. I always want to be humble.
Is it hard?
Oh, it's hard. Sometimes. It's hard. Sometimes I'll be in the shop and somebody will say, hey! And I say, if it was before, I will yell back. But this, I say, hey.
You've learned patience.
Yes. But before, if you say something, maybe you just say it without knowing what you were saying, oh, Peglin will really chew you. But now it's not like that anymore.
Is there a part of you these days that ever just wakes up and you just think, oh, I just want to go back to when I was just Peggy, working at the embassy, living my life?
Not at all.
Really?
Not at all. I love every bit of what I'm doing. So I don't reflect on the 4 a.m. call at all. All that I really care about is to move forward with them.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
You are quite welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Peggy Lean Bartel's new book is called King Peggy, An American Secretary, Her Royal Destiny, and the Inspiring Story of How She Changed an African Village.
It's been suggested that there are just 7 basic plots in all of literature. But author William Wallace Cook begged to differ. He argued there are, in fact,
1,462.
For example,
B's friend, B2, makes an important revelation regarding A, which causes B to correct a serious error.
Cook was a prolific pulp novelist. In just 1 year, 1910, he churned out 54 books, more than one a week. Cook wrote in every genre from romance to Western to science fiction. And to sustain that incredible productivity, he developed a detailed system of plots.
15A. B, plain and humble working girl, falls in love with A.
Naturally, Cook decided to turn his method into, what else, a book. And Plato, the master book of all plots, is our book this week. It was originally published back in 1928. It has just been reissued with an introduction by author Paul Collins, who joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
So explain to us how this works, because when you look through this book, it looks like this algebra textbook almost. You've got character A and character B, and then there can be B3 and A9, all, you know, pursuing mysterious X. I mean, in a nutshell, how has he structured this?
It's almost structured like this kind of mad thesaurus, basically, where you have these plot elements or these plot situations, and then each one is preceded by or followed by a bunch of numbers and letters that basically cross-reference you to a plot element that could precede or could follow the one that you're looking at. The idea being that you can recombine them in kind of this wild number of combinations. And this was actually something that for him arose out of necessity because he was, well, he was known as the man who deforested Canada. I mean, he cranked out this gigantic number of pulp novels. And he had to systematize it. I mean, he was literally manufacturing fiction to the point that when he wrote a memoir, he titled it The Fiction Factory. And that's a pretty fair description, actually.
227. B is unable to marry A because her father FB, in using B for his subject in a scientific experiment, has instilled a poison into her blood.
It's almost like a how-to guide for writers. Every possible permutation you could come up with, he's come up with, and he's made it into this guide. I mean, it's almost a way to mechanize fiction, I guess.
Yeah, and fiction was being mechanized at that point. When we describe a novel as formulaic, that's usually meant as a put-down, but it was actually a necessity for a number of writers at that time because pulp novels were this gigantic market. But it was a market that actually paid very little to the writers. So to get by, you had to do things like crank out novels every few weeks or every week in his case.
Did he ever explain where he got his ideas from?
You know, to some extent, they actually came from newspapers. He would clip things out of newspapers as plot elements. And he initially had this filing system, a fairly elaborate filing system that he came up with. It was basically the larger version of this book. It was sort of like a filing cabinet with all these plot elements. But yeah, a lot of this actually started, and as was actually really typical for pulp novelists, they would just draw stuff from the headlines.
They must have been reading some pretty amazing headlines because some of these plots are just unbelievable. I mean, just to open, let's have a look through. Let's pick number 607, and I'll read. A and his friend A2, explorers, are alone in the jungle. A's friend, A2, goes insane from eating the berries of a strange plant and makes a murderous attack upon A. This could be the next great pulp novel. What kind of guy was William Wallace Cook to sit around and thinking of these things, of, you know, berries of a strange plant and murderous attacks?
He was a pretty curious figure. You know, his memoir is almost completely consumed with describing the process of writing and of cranking out this stuff so quickly. By his own account, he went through 25 typewriters in the course of his career.
Wow. Now, I have to ask, as you have leafed through these, do you have a favorite plot that he managed to come up with?
I think off the cuff that one of my favorite plot elements that he threw out, just because it's so weird, it's this one. This is number 1367B. A has invented a life preserver for the use of shipwrecked persons. A, in order to prove the value of a life preserver he has invented, dons the rubber suit, inflates it, and secretly, by night, drops overboard from a steamer onto the high seas.
I'm sure we've all read that one somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's easy to laugh looking back at this, but this was actually influential in its day. You write that a young Alfred Hitchcock sent off for a copy.
Yeah, he did. He mentioned it in an interview in 1970, where he was talking about getting started in his career in Britain in the 1920s as a silent film director. He recalled ordering this book. He had to special order it from America. And one of the curious things about Plato is that it's had a particularly strong afterlife, I think, among screenwriters. A lot of this whole idea of formulaic plotting in its early versions, like Plato, actually was associated with movies as much as with novels.
It makes sense.
Yeah, I think in part because the way movies were being pitched and developed, it was as a series of plot elements, particularly, in the silent era.
Well, do you ever find yourself watching a movie or reading a book and thinking, I recognize that. That's number, 942B.
I have to say, I've never read a book where a ventriloquist is freed from a tribe of cannibals because of his ability to throw a voice to an animal.
But somebody out there is waiting to write it.
Yes. One of the funny things about reading Plato is that you really do get a strong sense of how plot works. And that actually, in its own way, was influential. Earl Stanley Gardner, who wrote the Perry Mason books, said that he basically learned about plotting from Plato.
That's author Paul Collins speaking to us about the new edition of William Wallace Cook's book, Plato, the master book of all plots. Paul Collins, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
And we should also thank Bob Mondello, who provided the dramatic readings from Plato.
1175B. A and A2 are friends, but one of them is a criminal and a fugitive from justice. Which of the two is a criminal?